Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're reading from the sixth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 4, text 11. Atishtata shatam margam kopam yachata dipitam pitra pitahenapi justam va prapitamahe atishtatasatam margam kopam yachata dipitam pitra pitamahenapi justam va prapitamahe atishtatashatam margam kopam yachata dipitam pitra pitamahenapi justam vah prapitamah atishtatashatam margam kopam yachata dipitam mitra pitamahenapi justam va prapitamamaha. Matas. Atishtata, atishtata, just follow. Shuttam margam, the path of the great saintly personalities. Kopam, the anger. Yachata, subdue. Dipitam, which is now awakened. Pitra, by the Father. Pitra Mahena Api, and by the Grandfather. Justam, executed. Va, your. Prapita Mahahe, by the great grandfathers. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta, Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The path of goodness traversed by your father, your grandfather, and great-grandfathers is that of maintaining the subjects, prajas, including the men, the animals, and trees. That is the path you should follow. Unnecessary anger is contrary to your duty, and therefore I request you to control your anger. Purport. Hear the words Pitra, Pitra Mahenapi, Justam Va, Prapitama Prati, Tamahahai depict an honest royal family consisting of the kings, their father, the grandfather, and their great grandfathers. Such a royal family has a prestigious position because it maintains the citizens or prajas. The word praja refers to one who's taken birth within the jurisdiction of the government. The exalted royal families were conscious that all living beings, whether human, animal, or lower than animal, should be given protection. The modern democratic system cannot be exalted in this way because the leaders elected strive only for power and have no sense of responsibility. In a monarchy, a king with a prestigious position follows the great deeds of his forefathers. Thus Soma, the king of the moon, here reminds the Prachetas about the glories of their father, grandfather, and great-grandfathers. Translation, the path of goodness traversed by your father, grandfather, and great-grandfathers is that of maintaining the subjects, prajas, including the men, the animals, and the trees. That is the path you should follow. Unnecessary anger is contrary to your duty, and therefore I request you, control your anger. I offer my humble obeisances to the lotus feet of my spiritual master, who has opened my eyes, blinded by the darkness of ignorance, with the torchlight of knowledge. I'm going to comment briefly on the verse. Then I've been asked to give some review of the glories of Lord Shiva on this day, which is being celebrated, Shivaratri. So I'm going to read some selection from some pastimes you may not know about Lord Shiva, particularly if we get time. The presence of Lord Shiva in Vrindavan during the time of Krishna's pastimes. And I don't know if so many of you are aware, but Lord Shiva was there to give protection to Lord Krishna 5,000 years ago. You know that? Not so well known. So, today we have the vestiges of royalty. You know, the Queen of England and some royals in and amongst Spain and Netherlands. We had royals about 150 years ago in Hawaii. It was actually a queen that ruled that land, and she did a very nice job of maintaining the benefits for all the citizens there. So royalty has been gradually waning as Kali Yuga has been progressing. And now we're just seeing, in 100 years maybe, you won't see any royalty. Gradually they are disappearing. And the idea of royalty, the function of royalty, which has been deteriorating for the past 5,000 years, can be seen in the people like the queen and the kings of Queen Antoinette and Louis the 14th, the 15th, the 16th, the sun god, he was called, because they had throughout history, they've had this weak and inaccurate understanding of the position of royalty, because the king is representing Krishna or God. That is the position of the Raj. And in his most matured form, he is always thinking of the welfare, just like King Yudhisthira was thinking of the welfare of all of his subjects, all of the so-called citizens. And Prabhupada mentions here that in this age of democracy, we can't expect that the leaders will give any protection because they are striving only for power. And what's underneath that? A democracy elects a lowest common denominator. You know what I'll try to explain what that means. But before I do, I would like to invite anybody who didn't get enough rest last night, don't feel that you have to sit here and fall asleep. You know, take an hour of rest. So don't be embarrassed to get up and go back to the ashram and rest. I respect for your honesty in doing that, really. If you didn't get enough sleep. I'm pro-sleep, believe it or not. So, anyway, the way in which democracy operates is that it has to elect that kind of person that represents the average intelligence. It can't elect the most intelligent people because it's a combination of the stupid, ignorant, tamasic people and a few people who may have some sense of sattva-gund in their intelligence. And it has to then elect the person that represents all of them. So you're always going to get mediocre people. You can never expect good leadership in a democracy. And without good leadership, without saintly leadership, kingly saintly leadership, it's disaster. But people are so covered, they don't have any knowledge of the actual method of government coming from the Supreme Lord, nor is there anybody qualified, that as people who are born into this Kali Yuga, we are naive to have any expectations of anything but mediocrity and worse. Now, flashback, when Prabhupada came to America and the flower children were protesting the wars and promoting free love, peace now, right? How Prabhupada must have looked at us and seen these innocent children. They have no idea that they are powerless in the face of this Kali, the systems of government of Kali Yuga. They are completely naive. Isn't it? He must have looked at us really like, even we were 20-some years old, what children these people are. Prabhupada was never illusioned by the way in which government operated. But we were. We had an ideal. We lived in an idealistic world that the words of the founding fathers in our democracy could actually be realized in this age of Kali. And then we met Srila Prabhupada. I don't know if you know the story of the Pied Piper. Pied Piper was a English invention of some author. And he came into town playing his flute, like Krishna plays his flute. And he enchanted all the kids in the town to follow him away, leave the town. He was called the Pied Piper, and he took all the kids away because of his enchanting nature of his music. So this is Prabhupada, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. He was the Pied Piper. He came into town and he was blowing the flute of this transcendental knowledge. And some of us heard that music and we went, oh, he knows much more than what we learned in our schools. And all of our illusions began to become dissolved, and we saw the truth about our situation and our so-called fanciful world of democracy. I love it when I read in the papers or in the Wikipedia, India is the world's largest democracy. And it's true. You have the most people, most elections, and the most corruption. Just out of sheer numbers, the most corruption. Not that other places aren't as densely corrupt, but just out of sheer numbers, it's the most corrupt. And here we read in these purports about how these living entities, these jiva souls, are born. Their janma is in these royal families because they're predisposed to take up the great task which has been exemplified in their lineage. You know, musicians are born in musician families often, and actors are born in thespian families, and scientists, a lot of them, are born in scientific families. Now, how India became a software country when many of these children's parents were farmers, I have no idea. That's a conundrum. That is a riddle. Although Indians by birth have far more innate intelligence than any other country in the world. You know, the best mathematicians were here. And all of the science that the Arabs claimed to have developed in Persia were all derived from Indian science and methodologies. But the world doesn't really have record of that. Record keeping in India only really became systematized when the British started to do it. Otherwise, everything here was oral tradition and apprenticed. And it wasn't until some very inquisitive and fascinated British managers who came here, they became completely taken by the fact that there was no history. And so they began to collect these various manuscripts around the country and make something systemized. But that's one of the reasons the world doesn't acknowledge India's contributions, because they weren't written in forms that were actually formalized and presented to the world. So similarly, the kings of India, the Rajas, became in Kali Yuga very corrupt. And they were not looking for they were simply interested in the lagan, you know, the taxes, and their lifestyles to be so ornate and full of calm sense gratification. So, anyway, to get me started on this, I want to turn our attention to Lord Shiva in a minute. But the fact that the trees are not protected, the citizens are exploited everywhere around the world, why are we surprised? And we are always amazed. You read the newspaper every day. It's some mutation on how somebody exploiting somebody else, sexually exploiting or exploiting them with money or powering over. And why are we surprised? Because we're still in the illusion. We still have some hope. And what's so interesting about the fact that Soma is bringing this attention to about the history of a family and why the family history is still considered important, maybe not for the right reasons, is much of what we do in the world is about looking good, because that's reputation. And we want to look good. Why do you think people have fashion? They want to look good. They want to look better than the next person. You see how these women or men dress when they come for these weddings? Some of these threads, we call them in the West, some of these threads costs, you know, lax. They're hand done in certain places with gold and all kinds of, you know, they I don't know why people want to be like that, but that's how people in the material world are. They want to look good. So Soma is using that idea. Listen, here's how good your parents were, and your grandparents, and all your ancestors. If you want to look good, you have to be like them. You know, he was using a certain psychology. I see some devotees. You know, they always look really good. You know, everything's pressed. Everything's... Srisi Gauranitai, Srisi Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman, Srisi Rasa Bihari, Lalita Vishakha Ki Jai. So he's using this idea. And Prabhupada also wanted us to look good, but he wanted us to look good in a certain way. As Vaishnavas, nice tilak, nice kirtans, harinam, nice Vaishnav dress, cleanliness, like that. So looking good can be used in Krishna's service. Prabhupada also mentions that a woman should dress in a very attractive way, not just for her husband, but for the deities. He actually mentions that. So looking good is not a bad thing in and of itself. But for whose pleasure? That's the point. And therefore Soma reminds the Pachetas about the glories of their father, their grandfather, and their grandfathers. Don't let them, their reputation, be spoiled. And you see that today in India, where if a woman marries someone or a man marries someone outside their caste, or they become engaged to somebody or become pregnant without marriage or something, it looks so bad. And you see these honor killings still going on in some places in Pakistan and even in India some places. This is all a misunderstanding of the whole principle of what it means to maintain a reputation. But it's a vestige. It's left over. And in the age of Kali, all these things are deformed and mutated, almost beyond recognition. But they're coming from a pure place. The caste system is coming from the Varnashram. It's a pure place. Reputation is coming from, let's put the pressure on. How do you keep people from exhibiting their anger? You know, we call something road rage, right? When somebody, especially in the Western countries, they get so angry they get out of their car with a crowbar and they start hammering at the other person. You know, it's called road rage because they're growed. Their anger is out of control. How do we control it? Well, we have rules. We have laws that if you do that, you go to jail. And those punishments keep everything in check. There was a book called Lord of the Flies about a group of young children who got marooned on an island with no adult supervision. There was a shipwreck. And it showed how mean, without checks and balances, how human nature can be so cruel. So here, someone's acknowledging that, by the way, this is a material world, you're going to experience this anger. Keep it in check. And one of the reasons you should keep it in check is to protect the reputation of your ancestors. It's fair game to make that kind of pressure, because he had a big job to protect all the subjects. So in that way, I can understand why Soma is making this plea. And we also make that plea amongst ourselves, because anger is there within each one of us to one degree or another. It will come out. And we also have to think that we have Prabhupada's reputation to protect. and the temple's reputation to protect, and the reputation of our brother and sister devotees to protect. And if we just allow our anger to explode, it doesn't just affect us, it affects everybody. So, it's just one other way in which we can keep things in check, when you keep them in perspective. When you understand that a lot of what exists in this material world is about looking good. And we're going to do that too, but we're going to look good for the benefit of Krishna, not for the benefit of ourselves. So now I would like to move on to speak a little bit about Lord Shiva. A lot of things that I have no experience of as a person from the West confounds me, the whole Shaivite tradition. Nevertheless, I understand it after and accept it after so many years. I mean, you have the advantage, if you're Indian, of living with the lingam as a, you know, as a cultural and traditional expression of how Lord Shiva is represented. But in the West, we have come from an Abrahamic tradition, a Judeo-Christian tradition, even a Muslim tradition that's also Abrahamic, based on Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, these characters who probably did not exist. But anyway. And there is a Ten Commandments. And in those Ten Commandments, one of those commandments is that one should not worship idols. Because the Jews were, and they came from the Egyptians, they were ruled by the Egyptians. They were slaves to the Egyptians. And the Egyptians had many idols. Many gods, Osiris, this god, that god. So the Jews also took that up, you know, by association. They had their own. And when they finally escaped from the Egyptians, Moses went to the mountain and received the Ten Commandments. And one of the commands was that thou shalt have no other gods before me. And so therefore the idea of an idol or a deity became an anathema, became repulsive to the people of the Judaic, Christian, Islamic faiths. It's just like Shankaracharya, who had to promote impersonalism in order to nudge people onto the path back on the path of the Vedas. So similarly, this was a similar pastime, where because they were worshipping so many gods, false gods, then Krishna made that arrangement for them that they ended up not having any deities at all. So you're very fortunate here because you have this balance of having the tradition of deity worship. At the same time, you understand which deity is the supreme. Once at the dawn of the universal creation, a great sacrifice was performed by the leaders of mankind, mainly Marichi and Daksha and Vasishta, and all the great personalities and the powerful sages and philosophers and demigods, along with their followers, assembled. And Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva were also present. When Daksha, the leader of the Prajapatis, entered into the assembly, his bodily luster was so bright that practically everyone present seemed insignificant. And influenced by Daksha's luster, they gave up their places and they stood in respect. Lord Brahma, of course, is considered to be the first living entity and the creator of the material planets and the entities. And he's empowered directly by our original Supreme Person, Sri Krishna, Vishnu. So he was at the head of the assembly. And although Lord Brahma did not rise to honor Daksha, he did adequately welcome him with words and asked him to take a seat. But Lord Shiva alone remains seated without showing any respect. And Daksha became very offended. You're familiar with the story. So instead of taking his seat, Daksha began to curse Lord Shiva. And this was a misunderstanding. And it resulted in widespread destruction. You see, Lord Shiva is a pure devotee of Lord Krishna. And an intelligent person who worships Lord Krishna is a Vaishnav. And in our Vaishnav Purana, it's stated that Shambhu, Lord Shiva, is the greatest Vaishnav. Vaishnavanam datam Shambhu. Lord Shiva himself declares in the Shiva Purana that one should take to devotional service of the Supreme Lord Vishnu. But Daksha, he spoke against Lord Shiva. All the sages and Brahmins and fire gods present here, I'm speaking about the manners of gentle persons. I'm not speaking out of ignorance or envy. He very tactfully presented to the assembly that he was going to make a sensible speech, not out of enviousness. And although he was speaking like a man in ignorance by intending to attack Lord Shiva's behavior, and although all present were perfectly aware of the exalted position of Lord Shiva, Daksha was so envious that he tried to cover his poisonous statements. Very clever. Very clever guy. With a plea for gentleness and non-enviousness. And then he launched into his, you know, this is one of, like when you say some, with all due respect, and then you start to criticize somebody. You know, so similarly, that's what he's doing. And he then said that Lord Shiva had ruined the good name of the demigods and that he's unclean. And he stated, although Lord Shiva has already accepted a position subordinate to me by marrying my daughter, yet he's not respectful to his father-in-law. Now the fact was that Lord Shiva's wife Sati was the daughter of Daksha, and they'd married under the instructions of Lord Shiva's father, Lord Brahma. And since Lord Shiva was actually the son-in-law of Daksha, one might ask, well, why didn't he stand up and pay respects? Anybody know? Yes, he was meditating on the Supreme Lord Krishna. It reminds me how when Prabhupada came in one time, all the devotees were taking prasad. And so they all turned to offer their obeisance to Prabhupada. Prabhupada stopped them. He says, no, you're honoring prasad. You don't offer obeisances. You honor the prasad first. So sometimes when you're doing something, it takes precedence over something else. There's a pecking order of things we do. For example, we don't offer obeisances to each other in front of the deities. That's in the nectar of devotion. Certain priorities that we learn how to, that are for our welfare, and they also are rule, the kinds of little rules that offer respect in a very peaceful manner. So then Daksha said, well, Shiva remains in the filthiest places, like the crematorium, and his companions are ghosts and demons, and he remains like a madman, and he never bathes regularly, and he puts a garland made of skulls on dead bodies around the neck just for ornamentation. He's very dear to crazy people in the mode of ignorance. And on the request of Lord Brahma, I handed over my chaste daughter to him, although he's devoid of all cleanliness, and his heart is filled with nasty things. So, obviously, it was not a very pleasant introduction in that assembly. Now, he cursed him out of envy, and Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti says in regard to this curse, by which Lord Shiva was cut off from participating in the sacrifice, that it was an indirect blessing for Lord Shiva. As the greatest devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it's not worthy that Lord Shiva should eat and sit with materialistic persons like the demigods, who might be a distraction to his prosecution of devotional service. So he was saved from the calamity of their non-Krishna conscious association. Who knew? Daksha was a very powerful mystic Brahmin. But under the deadly influence of anger, here it comes up again, he declared he would not bear to carry on in the presence of unclean Lord Shiva, so he left. And all the sages and Lord Brahma requested Daksha, don't leave. But in spite of all the requests, he went and he was angry, very cruelly angry. In the Bhagavad Gita, it's advised that anyone interested in spiritual advancement must avoid lust, anger, and greed, huh? And he prepared to curse Daksha, as well as all the Brahmins present there who merely sat by and tolerated this cursing. Now, Srila Prabhupada writes about this. There is a long-standing dissension among the neophyte Vaishnavas and the Shaivites, by which they are always at loggerheads. Some Brahmins are not admirers of Lord Shiva, and they might enjoy him being cursed. But this is due to their ignorance of Lord Shiva's position as the greatest Vaishnava. Nankasheshvar, in his anger, did not follow the example of Lord Shiva, who was silent and tolerant. He couldn't tolerate the insult to a Vaishnava, and he counter-cursed Daksha and his followers, stating that whoever supported Daksha would be bereft of transcendental knowledge of the soul and devoid of knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He called Daksha a pretentious householder with only superficial knowledge of the Vedas. And such a person, he stated, although following all the rules and the regulations of the Vedas, is going to be attached to the temporary happiness of sex, and all in all, with no knowledge of the eternal, spiritual, blissful life. And Lord Shiva's aide further deemed that whoever attacked Lord Shiva would be doomed to continue seeking happiness in the nescience of materialistic education. You know how Prabhupada warns us, don't build educational institutes solely for the point of educating people materially. Right? So here it is, millenniums ago, kalpas ago. This is where it comes from. And so people who are cursed end up doing all these universities without God in them. And he also said they're also going to continue perpetually in the cycle of birth and death. Such attacks on the Brahmins are applicable to the so-called Brahmins of the present age of Kali, who claim Brahminical or spiritual status simply on the basis of heredity or birth in a family of Brahmins. In the scripture Vedanta Sutra, it is stated that the human form of life is meant for realizing the supreme Brahman. And that is the real business of a Brahman. But the so-called Brahmins cursed by Nandikeshvar were more interested more interested in materialistic things. Daksha said, so the whole issue became so complicated that, but the so-called Brahmins cursed by Nandikeshvar were more interested in living for maintaining the perishable material body and elevating their family position. And worst of all, they refused to recognize the pure devotee of the Lord, the personality of Lord Shiva. ignited by the envy of Daksha, Nandikeshwar wrongly cursed all the Brahmins present in a non-discriminate condemnation. The whole issue became so complicated that those who were not strong enough forgot their positions, and cursing and counter-cursing went on in the great assembly. It's been going on forever, these arguments, isn't it? We wonder, where do those arguments come from? It's been going on forever. You know, when you're married, you argue. Arguments are there between the husband and the wife. It's unavoidable. And a husband and wife that love each other in a unconditional way, they can argue and not curse each other for it. Because they know it's just a part of how people communicate. You know, arguing in and of itself is not a bad thing. It's been going on since time immemorial over this issue of Lord Shiva. It's arguments that end up with attachments of enviousness and resentments. Those are the arguments that become a detriment in our spiritual life. Vaishnavas, devotees, argue all the time. It's okay to argue. When Ban Maharaj went to Germany, he stayed in a monastery. And he told the abbot of the monastery, he says, your monastery is very silent. Nobody speaks. There's no noise here. He says, when you come to our mats in India, he says, there's all kinds of noise going on. People are laughing. People are crying. People are arguing. People are yelling sometimes. He says, in our mats, there's life. So that's a part of our life, is arguing. There's nothing inherently wrong with it. They're doing it here. But arguing with anger, with that crowd, that's when you get into trouble. As a reaction to Nandikeshwar's cursing, the Brahmin sage Bhrigu delivered a Brahminical curse to all the followers of Lord Shiva as follows. One who takes the vow of satisfying Lord Shiva or follows those principles certainly becomes an atheist, as he becomes diverted from the spiritual injunction. So it's understood that the devotees of Lord Shiva sometimes imitate the characteristics of Lord Shiva rather than follow his example. Lord Shiva once drank an ocean of poison, so the followers of Lord Shiva, without being able to drink even a fragment of that poison, imitate him and take bong. That's why they have no, they think it's okay, because they're imitating him. They've been cursed. We should feel compassion for them. Bhrigu delivers the curse that if somebody follows such principles of intoxication, he must become an infidel against the principles of Vedic regulation. Lord Krishna himself declares in the Bhagavad Gita that he descends and corrects the regulative principles when there's too much general disregard of the prescribed rules for spiritual progress. So anybody seriously interested in prosecuting spiritual life has to follow in the footsteps of the Supreme Lord, the scriptures and the teachings of his deputed controllers, or the Mahajans. We have to follow their example and not imitate. You know, Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill. Nobody can do that. Lord Shiva is a Mahajan or an authority in Krishna consciousness, and his unusual activities on behalf of Krishna may be completely independent of the injunctions of the scriptures. But his followers may not assume his stature. The Srimad Bhagavatam states, one should not try to drink an ocean of poison imitating Lord Shiva. And Bhrigu further states that the followers of Lord Shiva will turn against the conclusions of the scriptures. And it's confirmed in the Padma Purana that Lord Shiva himself, as Shankaracharya, was ordered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead to preach impersonal philosophy for the purpose, just as Lord Buddha preached the philosophy of Nirvana for a particular purpose. These purposes are mentioned in the scriptures, and in those instances, when it is required to preach some philosophical doctrine which is against the Vedic conclusion. In the Shiva Purana, Lord Shiva says to his wife Parvati, "In the Kali Yuga, in the body of a Brahmin, Shankara, I will preach the Mayavad philosophy in order to baffle the atheists." So it's found that the followers of Lord Shiva are mostly Mayavad impersonalists who believe in becoming one with the Supreme. And Lord Shiva himself, however, by virtue of his austerity and his devotion, is more conversant with the actual position, the constitutional position of the spirit soul. As stated in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna is the Supreme Soul, we are His parts and parcels. Our position is qualitatively one with God, but eternally subordinate in quantity. The most elevated persons, the pure devotees, engage their lives, their minds, and intelligence in all varieties of service to the whole, to the Krishna. And Lord Shiva, as the greatest Vaishnava, was fully aware of all the intricacies. But Bhrigu cursed both Shiva and his followers as one in the fault. And he said, "The vow of worshipping Lord Shiva is so foolish that they imitate and keep bunches of hair on their heads and live the life of wine and flesh indulgence and do not take baths." And Bhrigu's point is that those who live without any spiritual regulation are foolish and become devoid of transcendental knowledge. He curses Nandeshwara and says, "Not due to my cursing shall you become an atheist, but you are already situated as an atheist and therefore condemned." Remember, this is going on just after the beginning of everything, that everything started, the beginning of the complete, Mandantar? You know, not just one cycle of the, but the whole, the very, very beginning. Well, when the cursing and the recursing was going on, Lord Shiva was silent. And he was sober. He didn't speak a word. He was so tolerant. But he became very sorry, very sad. So in order for the cursing and the counter-cursing to stop, what did he do? He left. He left the arena. What's the instruction that we get in the Nectar of Devotion when somebody is cursing or insulting the Supreme Lord? We're given a few choices. You can kill them, right? Or what's another choice? Leave the place, correct. Perfect Vaishnava. What did he do? He left the place. Well, Daksha then began another performance of sacrifice without Lord Shiva there. He deliberately did not invite Lord Shiva back. And generally, such sacrifices are pleasing to Krishna. And all the demigods, and especially Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, are usually invited. But being very proud, as is being head of the Prajapatis, Daksha avoided them. I mean, he understood that the purpose of sacrifice was to please the Supreme Lord, and his supposed logic in avoiding Lord Shiva was that if Vishnu is satisfied by a sacrifice, then what is the need of satisfying his followers? Big mistake. Big error in judgment. So, Lord Krishna says, worshipping my devotees is what? Better than worshipping myself. Our Guru Puja is actually better than worshipping Sri Sri Radha Rasa Bihari. Daksha's Shivalas sacrifice then became completely inauspicious right from the beginning. That's why when we have our yajnas, we what? In the beginning, all the mantras were inviting all the demigods to come witness. And in our Sundararthik, even Lord Chaitanya is there, present. If our mood is devotional, they're in attendance with us, isn't it? So there's this. I just touched on one small pastime of the amazing understanding that Prabhupada brings to us about Lord Shiva, who he is, what his position is, why he does the things that he does. In one, when we're reading his pastimes, sometimes we don't fully grasp the inner significance. I remember when I was understanding or reading that in the early days, I didn't quite get that Lord Shiva was, because he was meditating on the Supreme Lord, at that moment he was in a much more exalted position. And that's why he didn't get up and pay attention. He was absorbed. But I was like Daksha when I was reading. I didn't know. I had to read this over and over and over again just to get the intricacies, the inner life of what's happening. So my suggestion is that when we look at each other's behavior in devotional life, we take example from that. Rather than rush to judgment, we need to really inquire. Prabhu, what's going on with you? Why are you acting? Why are you not doing this? Or why this? Why that? Maybe there's something we don't know. Just like we don't in the beginning, we don't always understand these pastimes. And then it takes reading and rereading and maybe some other commentary to read about it. Finally, we kind of get it. So similarly with each other, we should have that same mood. Because some of us act in very strange ways. Almost like some devotees are almost like avadhuts, you know. But upon further inquiry, perhaps we'll come to a deeper appreciation. Maybe not, but it's a possibility. So let that be our, whenever we see someone worshipping Lord Shiva, as we do every day, we go across the street, we see so many people worshipping Lord Shiva. Maybe there's something we don't understand about what they need, and we have room in our hearts that in due course of time, these people will also come to understand what we understand. So are there any, just to take a couple questions because it's already after 9. If there are any questions, comments? Okay, then thank you very much. May you enjoy this Shivratri in a more elevated state of consciousness through how we're taking instruction from Srila Prabhupada. And thank you very much for listening. All glories to His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki.